Welcome to the Entertainment Engine.
Hi, I'm Pete Moore.
And my name's Bex Gregory. And together, we are the co-hosts of the Entertainment Engine podcast. We are really excited to share more information about our show.
The podcast is for new and existing creators working in music, film and TV. Weekly, we provide our listeners with information, advice and knowledge to help people navigate a career in the entertainment industry.
Plus, we have fantastic guests from the world of entertainment who share their stories with us, where we learn from their experience of working in the entertainment business, built in with some fun facts along the way.
So be sure to subscribe on your favourite podcast platform.
You can find us on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, Google Podcasts, plus many others.
We look forward to welcoming you to the show.
This week, we had a really great opportunity to speak with Nick Beveridge, Head of Finance at Made Up Limited and Senior Investment Manager at the Ingenious Group. Nick is an investment manager responsible for the day-to-day running of the finance department, dealing with the maintenance of the accounting records to detailed implementation and monitoring of business plans and cash flow. Prior to joining Ingenious in 2007, Nick was part of the CMO management team who managed the likes of Gorillaz, Blur, Machiba, Ultravox and Thin Lizzy, where he was the assistant financial controller for 10 years. Before that, he worked with the Hilton Hotel International. We really hope you enjoy the conversation we got to have with Nick.
Well, thanks for joining us again today on the Entertainment Engine. And today we have another special guest, and this time it's from our hometown in London, Mr. Nick Beveridge. Nick, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad.
Yeah, we're doing all right. It's a bit rainy here today. The weather's not that great, but that's the UK for you.
It is, yes.
So, you know, the ultimate question, Nick, how have you been coping with this thing called the pandemic over the past 12 months?
To be honest, I've been busier than I have been probably in my entire life. I went part-time at Genius in December 19 to set up my own consultancy and started working with Meetup and a few festival clients. So got my feet under the table with them companies. And obviously when the pandemic hit, you know, my experience in finance was that they turned to me, said, oh, you know, what are we going to do? So it was a case of, you know, forecasting, cost flowing, furloughing, unfortunately making redundancies, applying for grants, rent relief, local council grants, and all of which is, you know, quite new work to most accountants. So you were sort of rolling up your sleeves and trying to understand how to do these things. So it was a very, very busy year for me, and still is. And obviously now that the pandemic is kind of over to a degree, it's sort of, you know, maneuvering these companies back into where they left off before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Obviously the festivals are in a great place because, you know, everyone's dying to get out. So tickets, most festivals are sold out. But now it's a case of the challenges that the local councils and police have got, because they can't really enforce any measures because nothing's legal, but still fun and games with them. Mm. And obviously for like Made Up, you know, it works predominantly with brands and live events, and you know we're getting back into quite a decent shape, and it's still losing money, but little bits of money, but it's in the right direction, going in the right direction.
Well, that's good.
Good too. Yeah.
And Ingenious as well, you know, has been very, very good to, you know, been very good to the staff to, you know, work from home. We can all do what we do at Ingenious from home, and we've all been very active with things might take longer than used to, but they're still getting done. So between Ingenious, Made Up and other clients I've got, I haven't really stopped.
Positive.
Well, that is positive. And that sort of leads me on to how was your trip to Ibiza? Was that work or was that just sort of to have a break?
No, That was Harbour Break. We went there. Went there last year with the family, and I did a bit of work out there. But this year it was mainly holiday, so it was a nice break. It wasn't without pain with testing and form filling. I mean, coming back to England, you had to take a test. You had to prove you had a negative test. You then had to go to the airport and provide four forms of identification. You know, so you had to show your test. Show that you'd ordered a test to get back when you got back to the UK, your locator form. And yeah, they weren't easy forms to even for me, who is a form filler for a living, to be honest.
Yeah.
It was graft. And, but it was good to get on an airplane and feel that speed and, you know, land in a hot country. It was great.
Yeah. Did you have to isolate and everything when you sort of got there or got back, or was it not too bad?
No, so when we got, because we've been double vaccinated,
yeah,
and you don't have to, from Monday that happened actually, so on the day we got back, the rules changed, you don't have to isolate if you've been double vaccinated, so quite fortunate timing.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, did you feel safe as well, Nick, on the plane? How did you feel about that?
Absolutely, the plane was a third full.
Oh, right.
We flew from British Air. We flew British Airways from City Airport, and it was a really good move because in Ibiza, coming home, the queue at the Heathrow flight was going out the door.
Wow!
Mm. And I thought, wow, we've really chosen the right flight here.
Wow!
So yeah, it was no problem at all.
Mm.
That's good. We just had a friend flow out to Los Angeles yesterday, Bex, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, and he said the same thing, actually. He said the forms and, you know, yeah, the procedures you have to sort of go through, and you've got to wear a mask, you know, for the full sort of 10-hour flight, you know, to America. So it's, it's got to be done, isn't it? It's the safety of others. But
yeah, yeah.
I think some airlines staff are different than others. So if you slip it off for 10 minutes, they don't say anything.
Yeah.
But I think there's other airlines that are really strict, or I think it's like the staff on the flight rather than the airlines.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Must
well, it's good you had a break as well. And plenty of food, sunshine, and a beer, I suppose.
Absolutely. In that order.
Well, it sounds like it's well deserved. I mean, you've been busy, so you needed that break.
It was. It wasn't cheap, but Ibiza never is.
No.
No.
But was it worth it? It was worth every penny, yeah?
It was worth it, yeah. It was.
That's good.
Well, that's good. That's good to hear.
So going back to sort of like the beginning of your career then, Nick, I believe you started at the Hilton Hotel International.
Yeah.
How was that sort of experience and how long were you there?
So I did hotel management at university. Well, it was Polytechnic back in the 90s or almost late 80s. And obviously after I came from Inverness all the way to Colchester to study that. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, I loved London. So it was like, right, I've done that. I'm staying here. Let's get the first job that comes up. And the Hilton Hotel had accommodation. So it was an easy decision. Let's get in here. And so I was there for about 2.5 years, probably 21 to just under 23. And I started at Terminal 4 and then moved to Kensington Hilton. At Terminal 4, I was on reception manager.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, I need to get out of this. The hours are terrible. The pay is terrible. It's good fun, but it's just, you know, your body clock's all over the place. So I thought, I want to work in the music industry. So I thought, if I can get work in accounts, then the accounts can lead me on to working as an accountant in the music industry. So I transferred to Kensington Hilton, worked in their accounts department, worked with a German boss who was an absolute bollock. But he sort of drilled me in and taught me how to use Excel. This is going back, like, you know, I can't remember, just when Windows 95 just come out.
About 10.
And I learned how to create a macro before I could make a number bold. So I started at the far end of Excel and got to know it quite well. So after a year, kind of fell out with the guys there because it was a horrible little office as well. So then left. I was going to go to San Francisco and DJ, but the Hilton decided not to pay me a load of holiday pay and whatever. So I ended up staying in London and looking for a job. And I just went to Reed Agency. So I was quite kind of like annoyed, angry little kid. So this girl just sat me down. this girl just sat me down and said, look, what do you want to do? I was like, I want to work in music or TV. She said, fine, I'll get you some part-time work until we get something comes up. A lot of job interviews come out. One was working with CMO, and another was working with a video, online video company. It's, you know, it's been before, like Sky and Virgin. So it was like a video on demand company. And the video on demand company, I think, was offering me 16,500. And CMO offered me 13,000, or I think it could have been even less. I can't remember. But it was. But when I went to CMO, everyone was wearing jeans. No, people were unshaven. There's t-shirts. I'm thinking, I like this. So I made the decision to join CMO, which was obviously 10 years was probably, you know, best 10 years of my life. So many great memories. And just, you know, so it started off mainly the main client was Blur, but obviously I got chapped into Ultravox and Thin Lizzy and a bit of Morcheeba, and we also did Elastica. And then after about 6 months, I was thinking, there's not really much for me to do here. So I said to my boss, I goes, look, you've got anything for me to do? Because, you know, I've spent a lot of the day not doing anything. So back in the day, when film companies or TV operators want to use a song for synchronization, all they would do is they'd ask the record company, and the record company or publisher would fax a one-page fax through to the management company and ask for approval. Mm-hmm. The manager would then return that fax saying yes or no. And we had this big folder of like approvals and denials. So I said, but boss, said, look, why don't you look through this and then look through the recording statements and publishing statements and see if we've been paid. So started compiling a, you know, really detailed Excel spreadsheet. And the first thing that cropped up is we haven't been paid for The Toys Are Back in Town for Toy Story.
Oh, wow. Right. Wow.
Which was 600 grand.
Wow. I mean, that's huge.
Wow.
So all of a sudden, my boss came and said, Chris Morrison came and said, are you sure about this? I goes, yes, I'm sure. Because I've looked through every statement and I can't find any payment for this.
Yeah, yeah.
And this was obvious. Everyone has seen this on TV or films. Mm. Called up, I think it was Polygram at the time. It could have been, might be wrong, Universal. You owe me 600 grand. Two days later, we got a check for 600 grand for Thin Lizzy. And then he was like, right, there's the Blur folder. Get into that. So then I did the same thing. I compiled all the faxes. And the record companies wouldn't tell you if it was used or not. You'd have to, because the films would go after 20 songs and choose maybe two or three. Mm. So you'd have to, so then I said, right, okay. So then I'd go and buy the DVD and go right to the end and look at the credits, say, right, take a picture of it, and then send it back to the record company. He goes, you've used this song, you haven't paid us, pay up. So I spent a good couple of years really working hard on that, and that was great because it brought in loads of money to the artists and then essentially to the management company, because we were taking 20%. So that was real good fun, you know, getting my head stuck into that and then creating a system for the company to use going forward. I mean, obviously nowadays, I guess a lot of that's done digitally, and record companies will tell you if it's been used or not. But back in them days, it was kind of like no one really cared. It's like, are you sure about this? So that was great. Then there was also another like nice challenge. So back in the day, PPL used to hold about 25% of the distributions in case any featured artists were featured on a record. So I went in, and Blur had like 120 odd songs at that time that were registered with PPL. So to prove that there was no featured artist on any of these songs, you had to get the BPI form or MCPS form and say, look, there's the MCPS form, release up 25% of all the monies. So that was another good exercise as well, which took me a good, another between, I mean, going back to Thin Lizzy, that was quite difficult, but doing Blur and Elastica, Morcheeba is quite easy. And then one day, Damon walked in, or Chris walked in and said, Damon's got a new idea, it's called Gorillaz, you're going to do the accounts for it. And then, because it wasn't supposed to be as big as it got. And then obviously, you know, Damon made that first album, made the song, Clint Eastwood, went to Jamaica, spent £50,000 recording that song. We used to spend £150,000 recording and the whole Blur album. So for us to see that amount of money was wow. Mm. Then he came back, put the dart on, that sounded great. Went to radio. Radio said, that doesn't sound like an A-list. We were all very disappointed. The guy next door to Damon's studio, Ed Case, was hearing the music through the walls. I said, can I do a remix? He did the remix, the two-step remix, and the rest is history.
Wow.
Because it was a two-step mix that went bonkers worldwide.
Yeah.
And Gorillaz was born. And I remember going to La Scala to the sort of first gig and being up in the VIP area and turn around and there's Helena Christensen, Jude Law, Kate Moss, I mean, Manomi Combo. It was just full of celebrities. And we'd never seen that really backstage at the Blur concerts. So it was like, yeah, something's happening here. Something special is going on.
Wow.
And obviously to this day, it still is.
Yeah.
It's a great concept. It's a great idea. No one's replicated it. You know, the way that, you know, Damon gets all these different artists involved and, it's just a fantastic concept and it still is. So it was really, really great to be part of that movement at the beginning. And I've got some great artwork at home that I was given and the few bits I took. but yeah, no, it was great. We still see the gang from CMO. I mean, Niamh, who worked in our managers, Damon and Blur,
mm-hmm.
Brendan, who worked there, still manages Morcheeba. I still talk to Ultravox and Rusty Egan and Scott Gorham from Thin Lizzy. So, you know, it's not like everyone parted companies and fell out and never speaks to anyone again. So we were all out, actually, a few weeks ago at the forum for, unfortunately, a funeral. But, it was great. It was a great experience. And we all, you know, something I'll never forget.
It's funny how you mentioned that as well, isn't it? Because I came across Ed Case quite a few years ago and he was doing some remixes for me. And that's one of the projects he said that he did, the remixes for the Gorillaz. And that always stuck with me. And he was a really good lad. And I knew him. I haven't spoken to him for a while, but I knew him for about 10 years.
I mean, what I understand is that Damon lent him $5,000 the year before for studio equipment.
Yeah.
And he asked Damon, Damon said, I'll tell you what, you do a good remix, we'll call it quits on that $5,000.
Yeah.
But that was a good deal, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. He's a really good lad. And he was doing some stuff for me and other people, a couple of other managers I introduced him to. And he was just really cool.
Yeah.
And he had some of the artwork as well, I think, some of the sort of original stuff that he was doing. But he was really cool. I've not spoken to him for a long time, but it just shows you, Nick, how small the world is, isn't it, really?
Mm.
It also just shows you with music, it's not about, sometimes it's more about luck.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about skill. You know, you just got to be in the right place at the right time with the right sound and the right song. You know, really, that is probably the ultimate moment of luck for me in music.
Yeah,
no, I think, and also as well, Nick, with sort of going back a little bit, even today, some of the artists we talk to where, you know, they can't find their royalties, they got played in a film, but the film company is, well, we're going to give you this payment, we're not going to pay you this. It just seems to be, you know, cloak and dagger still all the time. And we've seen everyone jumping on the synchronisation wheel. And it's like, are you getting any placements? No, you're not. Mm. Are you saying you're going to get Mission Impossible 6? No, you're not.
It's such a competitive market as well, isn't it? Because everyone's trying to do it.
Completely, completely. I mean, that's obviously where the big bucks are. I mean, obviously, streaming does pay, but you could be a small artist. I mean, I remember, who was it? There was an artist back in the day, Roy Scop. Roy Scop, he was probably one, I mean, and the same as Morcheeba, to be honest. Morcheeba probably had more syncs than Blur. But Roy Scop had an album full of sync songs. He probably made much more money out of recording sales than he did at the synchronization, the recording income, because they were on that one-to-one, remember that mobile broadcaster?
Yes.
Yeah.
And a huge campaign with that, like lasting a year. So, I mean, but it is a really difficult, you know, you've got to have a great publisher with great contacts, otherwise you're just going to get left behind.
It is. And there's all these platforms as well, Nick, popping up saying they can do this and they can do that. And I'm thinking, I don't believe any of them. You know, it's like, do you?
No, we had a little record company at Ingenious that we signed. I'm not going to name. We signed to a someone exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard from them in a year. I haven't heard from them since I signed the contract, basically, with them.
Wow.
But they'll take it. You're completely right. Again, they're sitting on thousands of songs. I mean, I'd be interested to know how well Hypnosis are doing in that area, because that must be one of his key ways of generating revenues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he must know something that we don't.
Well, yeah. And a funny thing is as well, Nick, on that side of it, some of the people we sort of deal with in Los Angeles, and you know, they're really well respected music supervisors, you know, they're always saying it, they come direct, the film companies come directly to them, and the film company says what they want to do, and you know, it's a closed shop to a certain point. So I'm thinking, all these people that say they've got 50,000 songs and they represent, well, what are you doing with these songs? Because there's only one person going to sign off a song at Paramount or at Disney, and it's not going to be, you know, the songs you think it's going to be.
That's the problem, isn't it? Yeah. Unless you're direct as well. You know, they go through like third party after third party to sign it off, and I think that's where it breaks down. So you get lost in the mix.
Yeah.
I mean, even at Ingenious, you know, 15 years there, I mean, I'm not hugely involved in the film area, but I still don't know how it works, really, with films getting music placed into films. I really don't. Well, as I say, it's not a big, the films isn't, I mean, I'm doing a lot more work in the film than I ever have done before, but yeah, it's a definitely cloak and dagger world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think back in the day, some of the people that we know and have worked with, you know, major studios, film studios, Nick, they would say that, you know, the artist would phone up on that day, you know, the big act would say, oh, well, I've just done this song, do you want to place it? And they would get a yes or no. Now you've got 10 people in a line saying, oh, I can get you, you know, a Rolling Stone song. Well, no, you can't, because we know the man actually controls the Rolling Stones. So, you know, you can't get the Rolling Stone song. So,
I'm quite curious about it recently is there seems to be quite a few songs that are just plagiarizing themselves, like Gold, for example, by the Stones of Bali. With the Bold advert. And I heard, you know, that's fine, you know, it's done to death. But I also heard another sort of big 70s disco song last week, which has been converted into, the lyrics have been converted into the product. And I do think that some of these big hits, if they've been sold, I just do wonder if they've been sold to these 100% sold to the publishers, who've got complete control over it, can do that, can like obviously plagiarise the songs they bought.
Yeah.
And that would be obviously quite worrying for some of the artists that have sold 100% of the catalogues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know who I can't remember exactly who it was, but I think there's more of that to come in that world.
Yeah, I think so, because when you look at like the master and the composition, you've got 10 writers around the world, and you get a yes from 5, and you get 3 that say no. It's a real difficult process just to get anything through.
If you re-record it, you've only got to pay to speak to the publisher.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So then all of a sudden, the publisher's got 100% of it. Recording company, nothing to do with it. It's not your recording.
No.
So it's. I think we're going to see more of that.
Yeah, I think so. Cool. And you just sort of mentioned it just a little while ago, Nick. I mean, it sort of takes me on to your Ingenious career, really, like as a senior investment manager. It'd be really great to understand more about that process and, you know, what do you look for in a deal? What was your day-to-day like? How did it work? You know, it'd be great to learn more.
Yeah, so 15 years, actually just last month now, which the sort of first few years we were investing into music copyrights. So we did deals with Cooking Vinyl. We did a Prodigy album, which was, I think, was the biggest album in 2009, independent album 2009, Invaders Must Die.
Yeah, yeah.
Then we did some stuff with Independiente, so with Travis, and a few of their other artists, probably not so well known. Mm. We did work with Robbie Williams' aunt manager, Tim Clark, with IE Music.
Yeah,
So we did Sia and Passenger. Then we gave them, you know, funnily enough, it didn't, them two albums didn't work out, but then Passenger went on to become one of the biggest artists in the world.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Classic record company stuff. and we did some work with Eagle Rock, did some videos with Eagle Rock. We tried to talk to record companies about this, the how the VCTs work, and they didn't get it. They didn't get like how the model worked. So we ended up working with independents like Cooking Vinyl and Independiente, who did get it. And it wasn't, we had a couple of hits, but then as we were getting into it, illegal downloading was really starting to affect the industry. Mm. One of our artists from Scotland had like 300,000 illegal downloads that we found, and she sold about 10 records. And it was like quite destroying, because yeah. 300,000 CDs would have been a big ticket for us. So then we decided, look, this world's a bit crashing a little bit. So then we thought, someone came to us, it was obviously Tom Baker, Marcus Whedon, said, look, do you want to put on a live event? And we thought, yeah, we could do. So then we created the live VCT. We I don't know, about 30 million we raised. And then we put on a few live events, and it started off quite well. Because at the same time, we used to own, one of our fans had a 47% stake in Creamfields. Mm-hmm. So we kind of understood the live world. Yeah. So we did like a couple of gigs with David Hartfield at the, the Rewind brand. Started off at Powderham Castle, where we did like Boyzone and some Katie Malua. And then the next night we did a Rewind festival, and it went down a storm, the Rewind. So we said, well, this has got legs. So we rolled that out. And then from then onwards, we also had this other fan at Genius also had a stake in brand events. And brand events were doing Taste of London, Taste of Christmas. So we did a couple of joint ventures with them. And then sort of from there onwards, we just got a bit of a name in the live scene. So, which led us on to doing, probably at the height, quite a few, did the LED Festival, which was the Cream. We did a festival in Brighton, Shakedown, and a festival in Bristol. We did Love Supreme Festival. We did Liverpool Sound City, Field Day. We did a gay festival, Oswald in the Park, in Victoria Park. We did the Zoo Project Festival. We did Just for Laughs with Just for Laughs. We did Winterville. And, you had some hits and you had some misses. Mm. But overall, the live VCT was a very successful fund. It returned over £1 to investors. So with their tax relief, that was a really good return. Mm. We set up another fund called Impresario, which was predominantly to buy majority stakes in existing festivals that were profitable. So we bought SW4, 51% stakes in SW4. Rewind, Field Day, and there's one more, Boardmasters. And then we also bought a big share in Vision 9. Mm-hmm. And then sold it to Global at the right time. It was, it was absolute perfect time. I think if we'd waited another year, we'd have got half the money we got back for it. I mean, it's quite public knowledge what the deal was. So then we got out of festivals. And then my job since that point is to sort of wind down a few of the funds that I manage. So I've got an SEIS fund, which has got 76 sort of development companies in it. Anything ranging from, someone who makes chinos to a girl who vlogs about makeup, to a car pooling company, to film development deals, which is a very varied fund, so it's been quite entertaining getting my head around some of these companies I knew nothing about and had to understand how that business works. Hmm. So since then, and that's why sort of December 19, I said to my chief, said, look, my capacity is not 5 days here anymore. I could easily do this in three. I said, would you mind if I go, go part time, do 1 day at home, and then he was very supportive, which was great. But in the meantime, obviously, with Ingenious, like other companies, had to make changes. I'll call it. Staff changes, so we've all had to sort of roll up our sleeves and do things that we wouldn't normally do. So in the past, we'd have a legal department and a company secretarial department. You don't have them as many of them guys to turn to anymore, so you have to sort of get your head around a lot more stuff than you ever used to, which has been great learning curve, because before a document you want to check in, you just go send it to the lawyer. Okay, I'll do this. It's my job. But now you've got to kind of get your head around it yourself to a certain degree. And then if you've got any real thorough questions, you have to ask someone. Mm. that you've got to sort of do a lot of it yourself, which is good in a way. So yeah, that's where Ingenious, that's sort of like what my role has been, very commercial. Genius, but it's obviously the last few years it's been a lot more technical for me to get involved in, because it's obviously staff changes. So I mean, as for how do we look to do a deal, I mean, that's a really good question. It really is, because a lot of the time I always say to people, sometimes it's more about the person than the idea. Because if you've got a good person with a bad idea, or a bad person with a good idea, usually the good person will be more successful with a bad idea than a bad person with a good idea. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because a good person can turn, you know, nothing into something, but a bad person can struggle to deliver a good idea. And I'll give you an example. We're going to do a flower show, and the guy who had the idea, it's a great idea, and I've got a really good partner involved in it, who's quite big at the Chelsea Flower Show, who's really ready to roll our sleeves up. But we just looked at each other one day and said, this isn't going to work with this guy, because he doesn't know anything about flowers and flower shows. So we pulled it, and it was a shame, because I really thought it would have been a great event. And we're looking at it, it's going to be done at Austerley Park, lovely venue, really accessible for everybody. And you can drive there, you can take the tube there. Location's another good one, you know. So when we did Love Supreme with Cyril from and Jazz FM, when we drove around, you know, Jazz FM said majority of the listeners are in the south corridor. So we drove down to Brighton, very, you know, very lovely city. We looked at three venues, and Glen Place was the last one. As soon as we got there, it was, this is it, and it was. And it, you know, the first year lost a lot of money, but then it's now a very successful festival. And it's, I think a lot of it's down to the location. So location is one thing. You know, I mean, I know guys who, like, some successful promoters in the UK that try to go to Scotland and struggled. Location and partners are two key things. The idea is generally, look, a festival is a festival. At the end of the day, it's a stage with music and beer and food and camping if you want. So that bit's quite straightforward. Sometimes it might be a different element towards it, whether it's 80s music or rock music or dance music. But ultimately, you turn up, you go through a gate, you do what you do when you're at a festival. That bit's the easy bit. It's where is it going to be and how you're going to sell the tickets, or what's the concept of what you're trying to do. So, yeah, and then the process for getting approval on that would be, so I would get into detail with potential partners, go through budgets, go through the idea, and then if I felt it was worth presenting to the board, I'd create a paper and send it to the board, and they would say, let's have a better chat about it, or it would be quite a quick process. Yes, let's do it. It was generally... you know, quite a quick process.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I still obviously speak to quite a lot of people in the live industry who I'd love to invest in, but them funds are gone now. And it's not, I don't think it's just Ingenious. I think all the big players, like, you know, the Globals, the Superstrucks, any of the other big boys, I'm not sure how open their checkbooks are these days, but it feels like it'd be difficult to convince anyone to buy into a festival at the moment.
Difficult.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, taking it a little bit further, because I know obviously you get probably approached a lot with different projects, like you're saying, and how do you know how to walk away from a deal? I mean, you've touched on a few bits about what you look for, but what are like the big red flags, like immediately as soon as you see something, you think, look, this is not going to work, but, you know, what's the immediate sort of like, no, that's, you know, big red flag.
Usually someone trying to do something they've never done before.
Yeah.
That's probably one, even though they might've done a lot of research on something, you know, I mean, recently someone came to my idea about swimming pools, for example, investing in swimming pools. Obviously we don't have a fund for that, but courtesy, he was a friend of a friend, so we looked at it. And this guy done a lot of research, and he did have a good case. You know, there's not as many swimming pools in this country as there should be, and it's not an elite sport. It should be something for kids, but you know, we don't have experience in swimming pools, so And this guy, although he'd done a lot of research on swimming pools, he didn't really have any hands-on experience of swimming pools either. So he'd never actually managed a swimming pool or run a swimming pool. Mm. So someone coming to an idea they'd never done before is a bit of a red flag, because it's just an idea. Now, not saying that is always the right way, because I'm sure some people have got an idea and run with it, and it's very successful. But that's a bit of a red flag if they don't have any experience in it.
Yeah.
No fun. You know, another one is like, it's nice to see someone do something and get to a level themselves, and then say, I want to grow this. I've got this from A to B, but I want to go from B to D.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a bit of a green flag. Okay, you've done a lot of the groundwork. I like that bit, and I get it. And you see, if you're a bit more capital into this, then you've got so far up the highway that maybe we come on the journey with you. But if you've just like sat down and in your bedroom or your office within your house with an idea and haven't done much research and just thought, oh, this could work, that's just not good enough.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah, it does really. And I think, I suppose it's just dealing with all sorts of people as well, isn't it? Because you never know sometimes who's going to come through the door. But I think you touched on a really good point, is people buy from people. And even I think that's how we met when I came in to see you. At least we had a decent conversation, and it's sort of, this is why we're talking today, because I believe in keeping relationships and just keeping conversation going, because you don't know what's around the corner, really.
Absolutely. And there's been a lot of that, at Ingenious, where you say, look, they stay in touch, doors always open. And that's a bit of a mantra at Ingenious. Always have a coffee. We'll always have a cup of tea, have a chat. Because it's always good to understand what other people are doing, other people are thinking. So the door is always open to, hasn't been the last year and a half, but I'm sure it will soon.
No, for obvious reasons. No, the world's been put on hold. But also as well, within that put on hold, did you have a chance to, refocus and rethink as well about your journey? Did you get a chance to do that?
Fortunately, I did that before it happened, like 3 months before it happened, I did it. So, going part-time, Ingenious, set up my own consultancy. I was lucky. If I didn't do it in December 19, I wouldn't have had that busy year last year, because I was engaged with people before the pandemic. So, I didn't see the pandemic coming. So it was just luck. It was just that. So my journey has changed. I mean, obviously, I've got a great summer house in my garden where I can work from home. I've got a great office set up. Probably the best office setup of all the Ingenious staff, I'm quite enjoying the not commuting from Essex. But at the same time, I'm made up. I go in there twice a week. Up to we've just got a new warehouse in Southeast London, where it's good to get out, because I just don't think it's healthy to be working at home 5 days a week and then spending 2 days at the weekend with your family. I think you do need to engage with other people. And Ingenious, we're heading back there. I'll be down to like probably 1 day a week in the office at Ingenious, where you book a table, we'll be hot desking. And I do miss it to a degree, but I don't miss the traveling. But if you're only doing it half of what you were used to doing, that's well acceptable.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, and it probably makes you more fresher as well, to be honest with you. I mean, you're just traveling is great. I like traveling, but
you down, doesn't it?
Yeah. Sometimes you just want to go, what am I doing? Why am I sitting on this train, or why am I doing it? No.
Yeah, I mean, I still work. We did a festival at Ingenious called Brighton Boundary, which is on its fifth year, and the guys bought that off Ingenious, and they said, look, can you stay on? We're working with us. So sort of like once a month, I head down to Brighton, and I love it. I go down there, meet the council, meet the police, meet the partners, go for lunch, get trained back. It's who doesn't like going to Brighton? Who doesn't like going to Brighton for the day?
Yeah.
Get an ice cream.
Yeah.
Ice cream, yeah.
I was going to say, so what are the perks then with your job? I mean, I suppose all the events that you do, I mean, you don't have to buy a ticket, I suppose, see the event.
The funny thing is, when you used to run as many festivals as we did at Ingenious, the last thing you want to do at a weekend is go to a festival.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'd probably prefer doing the gardening.
Yeah,
so that you do get to that point. I'm 48 now as well, so you know, I'm sort of past my younger days of, you know, going out and doing that sort of stuff. But yeah, I certainly get enough requests from friends and family.
Yeah.
That use up my allocation. Put it that way.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, but so would you say you're more like sort of rocking at Rio, for example? You're more like in the garden with a deck chair and a you know, planting some roses or something, you know, and having a beer.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the music in the background, you know. Yeah, sun shining. Yeah, that's yeah. Yeah, oh, I mean, I'm also a big 80s fan as well, so there's you sort of move on in life, don't you, really?
Yeah, you do. And I know we sort of touched on it as well, Nick, but it'd be really great to get your thoughts on how have you sort of had a relationship with live music promoters? And I know you sort of said how you get a feeling for some good or some not so quite good. What would you say your overall feeling with working with live festival promoters had been over the last 15 years?
It's been good. You know, we've worked with some great promoters, like the guys from Cream, Scott and James Barton, were amazing to work with, taught me a lot. Mark Priest, he's worked for Radio 1 for a long time. Mm. There's been some the guys in Brighton, you know, Albie, who owns four nightclubs.
Yeah.
And his partner, Luke. So Donnie Newman from SW4.
Yeah. You
know, mm-hmm. I've had the Toppins who run Boardmasters. You know, we played golf with them. You know, my experience for live promoters who I've worked with has been great. And also Rob Starr from East Electrics.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, not just being a good experience working with them, but it's been a good experience knowing them and getting to know them and, almost calling them friends. Yeah. And then there's other people who I haven't worked with, who I've had equally as good relationships with.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think it's quite a nice industry. There's a few bad apples, but generally everyone's very, very friendly and quite together.
That's good.
Except when they roll up and try to put a festival next to yours.
Yeah, then
the knives can come out a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. But no, that's good that you that experience, because sometimes, you know, through my journey, you sort of meet people and you think, you know, sometimes some people that I've met, they want to put on big events and they've not had much experience, and you suddenly you're going to manage $1 million budget and you think, I'm not too sure about that. And, you know, so I think it's horses for courses, maybe, then, really.
Yeah, completely agree. So, yeah, overall, it's been I've had a good, that's why the 15 years of Ingenious has been enjoyable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you can. Probably your own gut as well can tell whether something's going to be good or not. And if you, like you say, you're in front of a good person, then you can work with good people, because they can come back to revisit the table and think, well, that was wrong, but I can do this now. So, yeah, it's positive.
Yeah. It's a bit like Rewind. You know, we tried out a Paradigm Castle with a couple of artists that didn't work, but the next night we did a load of 80s artists that smashed it.
Mm. Yeah.
And it was like, right, okay, we've got something here.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. And so it was good.
Yeah, so what would you change today about the entertainment industry? What do you like and what do you not like about it?
That's a big question, isn't it? Nice to see the artist fees come down.
That'd be a start. Yeah.
Well, I think that's going to happen. I think that's going to happen.
I don't think it is.
Do you not?
I did think that last year.
Yeah.
Okay. When we had, you know, the start of the pandemic and all the festivals were getting cancelled and the agents were, you know, we're in this together. But
yeah.
I don't know. These artists have had it's not the artists that have had a year out. Some of the artists I know, for example, have enjoyed having a year out because they've been on the road for years. But the agents have got big costs. They've got big costs. They made a load of redundancies. They've got big offices and they've got big overheads. So, and they're the ones that drive the fees. So, I don't think it will come down.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Mm. Fortunately. Yeah.
But we'll see. I mean, we'll see. I mean, that's a crystal ball question. But that's a change. I don't know. I think the live industry is a fantastic one, especially in the UK. I mean, it's a great, vibrant scene. You know, kids love it. Promoters love doing it. You know, suppliers like working at it. There's not much. I can't think of too much I would change apart from maybe cheaper tickets and cheaper artists, but the cheaper tickets come with cheaper artists at the end of the day.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I'm having many conversations like this, Nick, with just friends of mine that say, oh, I spend £250 on my festival ticket. Why does it cost this much? And I sort of break it down. So you see that stage, you know, that could be £500,000 stage, and the headline act is paid 6 months prior to them coming on the stage. Mm. And people look at me as if I've fallen off a tree, and I'm like, you just...
People don't get it.
I said,
No, I know.
I said, to give you an idea, like the agent will come and say, well, I want, you know, 50% of your budget. I want it now. And like, and if I haven't worked with you, they might want 100% up front. And people look at me in dismay, and I'm like, you just don't understand how this... You turn up and pay your money... Securities, thousands, fencing's thousands, as you know. And but the average Joe looks at it as, well, why is my ticket £300? You know,
it's quite a risky business. I guess one thing it would be good to change is to de-risk it somehow.
Mm.
You know, there's obviously the cultural recovery grant has been great for a lot of promoters.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, a lot of them promoters didn't use the money to run this year, which was a bit annoying. That's been great support for many, many people.
Mm.
But it'd be nice to see that continue for startup festivals, rather than just the ones that have been established and make good profits.
Do you think someone could start a festival today and be successful?
Yeah, I do. Whether it would have to be someone who's obviously got experience and track record.
Yeah.
I mean, I seen last week that Creamfields are announcing a 2-day camping festival at Highlands Park, where V Festival used to be.
Yeah.
On the same weekend. So I imagine that will be a 50,000 cap. I imagine that'll be a success.
Yeah.
I do. I think the food and the pub in the park brand, the food and music brand, concept is a great idea. I think that's got massive legs. I think we will see more of that. Not just playing, you know, walking into an electronic dance festival or a rock festival and it's just about bands and artists. I think the kids of these days want more experience when they get there.
Mm.
So more arty, probably maybe more politics as well.
Mm.
Yeah.
And you know, the sort of... I've sort of talked to a few people about the more yoga retreat element kind of festivals where they have loads of classes and talks.
Yeah.
And that's definitely not my bug, but I'm 48, and if I was 18, it probably would be.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think there was quite a few of them scheduled for last year that didn't obviously go ahead, and they probably won't go ahead this year. But I think next year, I mean, it's all about, you know, mental health becoming a big issue.
And that
sort of combines that mental health, yoga, well-being element of going out for a weekend. I think that's got, there'll be a future.
Yeah. I think people love all that.
It's good. Interesting.
After everything that's happened, I think people want that.
I just do think that the younger generation that's their bug. That's what they'll be up for.
Mm. Yeah,
we'll see.
Yeah, it's we'll interesting. So we're going to see lots of people in the field doing yoga.
As I said, festivals at the weekend, because I work them, not my bug, but that definitely isn't.
But there is
plenty of people who I think would be up for that.
Yeah.
And not just the younger generation either.
No. I think you're right, though. I do think the festival experience is gone more of an experience. So people want to try, you know, really great food. They want really different craft beers or craft drinks. Mm. And I suppose from a personal perspective, Nick, I'm not really interested in seeing the headline act. You know who the headline act is, and whoever it is, you go and see them. But I'm more interested in seeing the band that you haven't seen, and you have a beer and a burger, and you think, well, that was really good. And actually, they were really, really good to see. And you also... I don't know. What do you think, Bex?
I think people want to... They like to discover something new and be the first to kind of know about something. So I think people love all that, don't they? They feel like they're part of something at the beginning or something like that. So, yeah.
Love Supreme was quite good at venturing into that world. So we used to have yoga classes in the morning. We'd have dance classes in the morning. We had talks from Jazz FM. And I think, you know, Cyril, who runs that, was going to create a well-being festival, obviously last year, but that got cancelled. I think he's obviously swerved it for this year. But yeah, he's good at what he does, and I'm sure what he's got some good partners to run that, and it'll be interesting to see how that goes next year.
Yeah,
because he's dipped his toe in the water and seen the reaction of certain elements of it at Love Supreme, and that's sort of made him think, hold on, there could be a festival just around this, and I think he'll go for it.
Wow. There we go. Watch this space.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it'd be great to get your sort of take on this, actually, for just new creatives as well that are looking, you know, to come into the business, whether they've got a new event idea or anything like that. What sort of advice would you give to new creatives, you know, or promoters, you know, looking to come into the industry sort of today?
Do your budget first.
Yeah. Know your numbers. Yeah.
Do your worst case scenario on ticket sales and then work out how much your infrastructure is going to cost, and then see how much left you've got for your talent. And if you don't have a surplus fund to create to support a loss, then you're going to need to find one, because majority of festivals will lose money on the first year. So doing your ticket analysis, don't think you're going to get a load of sponsorship, because that really has hit rock bottom for festivals. This sponsorship for, especially for new ones. Do your budget first. Look at the cost of your infrastructure. If you don't know how to do it, get someone to do it, and then tell you how much money you've got left to spend on talent. And then if you can try and break even on your first year, you'll be doing really well. Mm. As I say, if you've got 100 grand a spare that is a bridging loan, because our model used to be you lose 100, make 100, make 300, make 600. So year after year. So if it's a success, you should lose it, make it back, and then make the money on the third year. Now, that's not like written in stone, but it's quite a decent way of looking at it. And a lot of promoters, I think, would support that model.
I think
what I mean, me and you used to talk about that, Pete, when we first met.
Yeah. And I think I echo that 100% as well, Nick, because I was always taught, I think when I first started and was doing sort of 300-400 capacity venue, and I was doing a lot of university stuff, as I was saying to you, and my accountant said to me, if you're going to go after it, external money or investors' money or sponsorship money, do your numbers. Do not rely on anyone else to do your numbers. If you want them verified by me, I'll look at them. But when you're in front of an investor, you've got to understand your numbers. And he always said to me, do your worst case scenario. Say if you need to sell 1,000 tickets, he said, just put in 400 and look at what loss you're going to make, because a good team around you will help you. So I echo what you're saying, really. And I think, I suppose another question really from me is, have you been in front of promoters or that have tried to blag their way and say, oh, well, we're going to sell this amount of tickets and blah, blah, blah?
Of course. And 9 times out of 10, they get shown the door.
Yeah.
Because anyone who comes in with a budget that says they're going to make £1 million in the first year, it's like, it's not real. No one does it. Not even Live Nation would manage to do that, or even, AEG wouldn't like entertain that. So there's no way Ingenious would either. That's you've got to be a bit more humble about the approach that here's going to grow. And the ones that see it like that are probably, more realistic about what's going on.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. So what's sort of next for you then, Nick, over the sort of, coming year?
Well, I spend quite a lot of time at Made Up. I go to 2 days a week, but I spend a bit more time, on that company, and it's heading in the right direction. We just moved warehouse.
Yeah.
We had 3 arches in Bermondsey. It was quite unworkable. We couldn't get on any massively big projects. We got a huge new warehouse with massive machinery for carpentry and metalwork. We're actually fitting a studio for Facebook today.
A TV studio
that we created for them. And they want another one done. We do some work with British Airways. The company started off doing events for Head Candy 20 years ago. It does a lot of work with the BBC. So the new warehouse has given us new capabilities to do much bigger jobs and compete with competitors we couldn't even get near in the past. So trying to maneuver Made Up into where it should be is a big challenge for me. And Yeah, I mean, it's obviously got an element in Ibiza, which has been massively affected over the last 2 years now.
Yeah.
So trying to get that back on track, because we've got hair. I mean, we've got a hair salon out there, which is quite a niche yeah. new company for me to get my head around.
Yeah.
Since I, you know, I haven't been a barber in years. So get my wife to cut my hair. So that's been quite entertaining just getting my head around that business. But yeah. we've also got a huge events business out there, which that needs to get back on track.
Okay.
So that's the sort of challenge for the next, obviously, for next year. Obviously, Ingenious is still a massive part of what I do. And, you know, returning money to investors is a huge challenge over the next year as well.
Mm.
So that's the sort of two main priorities for the next year is made up growing that company and some of these old fans at Ingenious is getting the money back to investors.
Mm.
Yeah.
And then obviously I'm involved in the festival in Brighton and trying to grow that as well. So keep that on track.
Yeah.
And then also I've also got another Arts Council fund coming out, which I've got a few clients to that they want me to apply for them. So I've become a bit of a Arts Council applicant expert. Which I'm not sure if you've talked to anyone who's done one, but it is like a degree you need to do one.
They
are not easy. So.
I hear you. I hear you.
You've got your work cut out then, by the sounds of it.
It's definitely, you know, the next 6 months will be very busy and the next year is going to be very busy. Yeah.
Yeah, lots going on.
So would you say your role that made up is pretty much the same as Ingenious? You've got to chase money and make sure things are all sort of running in that direction?
Yeah.
No, we've got a great bookkeeper who loves chasing money. I'm sort of sitting at a little bit higher level. You know, for example, we got an Arts Council loan, which also I've got to, not the grant, the actual loan. So there's only 23 companies in the country that got the loan. So we got one of them, but you've got to adhere to so many regulations, like updating management accounts, quarterly board minutes, annual reports. Yeah. You've got to do sustainable, how you're going to be more sustainable, more diverse. That's quite a big task, just managing that. Then we've got a new lease to do. The landlord's building another warehouse for us, a 6,000-foot warehouse. So that was sit on my desk kind of help manage design, how it's going to look inside. So sort of sit a bit higher level, and there's more of the strategy and keeping the wolf from the door, but not knocking on the door to get the money in. We've got something to do that.
Fantastic.
Well, I mean, it's been an absolute pleasure, Nick, speaking with you and just to learn more about your background. And yeah, we wish you all the best with everything that you're doing. It all sounds really exciting. So, but we appreciate your time coming on today.
Not a problem. It'll be great to get out and have a beer again.
It will, Nick. I felt we got on really well. And I thought, actually, because I wanted to get someone really great finance experience and just, you know, any new promoters or anyone out there looking to do something, at least they've got a point to say, well, actually, have a listen to what Nick's saying, and you know, hopefully they'll take some advice on board that you're saying.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's great advice.
As I say, I'm always happy to speak to people as well.
That's fantastic. Well, thanks for coming on.
Nice one. Thank you very much, guys.
Well, that's all for today's episode of The Entertainment Engine, and thanks for listening.
Join us again next week for more great guest interviews from the world of entertainment. It would be great to have your feedback on the show, so please drop us a message at any time. We would love to hear from you.
So make sure you subscribe to the podcast on your favourite podcast platforms so you never miss an episode.
Thanks for listening to the show. And remember to all stay safe.
The Entertainment Engine.